Hi everyone, welcome to the podcast series from the University of Calgary Sports Student Chapter. My name is Luisa Graziottin, and today we are going to discuss the challenges in defining and estimating a cost-effectiveness threshold. To talk about this topic, we have here Dr. Eldon Speckman, who is an assistant professor at the University of Calgary. Dr. Speckman is a health economist with a background in economics, epidemiology, and health services research. Dr. Speckman was also recently awarded by the Canadian Institute of Health Research a grant focused on estimating the cost-effectiveness threshold for cancer care in Alberta. So, Eldon, thank you for being here today.
I appreciate the invitation.
So, let's start simple. What is a cost-effectiveness threshold, and why is it important?
The goal of the cost-effectiveness threshold is to make the best use of limited resources. To do this, we make decisions based on the additional costs and benefits of new treatments or programs or technologies, whatever you want to call them. And we put this information together into an incremental cost-effectiveness ratio, or what we call an ICER. So the ICER gives us the cost per each additional unit of benefit produced by the treatment of interest compared to the next best option. In a situation where the new treatment has additional costs and additional benefits, there's no obvious decision about whether to reimburse this new treatment, so a trade-off must be made between the additional costs and benefits. So to do this, we compare our ICER to a cost-effectiveness threshold. If the ICER is less than our threshold, then we would pay for the new treatment, and if it is more, then we would not pay for the new treatment. And that was kind of a long way to say that it's a decision point we use to determine the cost effectiveness of new technologies or interventions. However, not all cost effectiveness thresholds are created equally, so the effect of using the given threshold depends on what it represents and how it is calculated.
So the follow-up question to that would be, how can a cost effectiveness threshold be estimated?
So before we figure out how to estimate something, we need to figure out what we're trying to estimate. So we need to decide what our cost effectiveness threshold represents. So Mike Paulden, who you've had on this podcast before from the University of Alberta, uses a really good example of two stalls selling the same apple. So if you have a willingness to pay for an apple of $1 and one stall is selling an apple for $1, and the other is selling the exact same apple for 50 cents, you would always buy the apple for 50 cents, even though you'd be willing to pay up to $1. What you may not realize is that you've just made the decision based on your opportunity cost, because to buy the apple from the first stand, you would have to give up the opportunity to buy two apples from the second stand. In this example, we make the most efficient allocation by considering our opportunity cost rather than our willingness to pay. And this is the same for health. If our willingness to pay for health exceeds the opportunity cost of health, maybe we aren't spending enough on health and we need to increase the budget. But the best allocation of our current resources always depends on the opportunity cost. So many methods have been used to try to estimate a cost effectiveness threshold. Originally, decision makers looked at the ICERs of past decisions, and some have tried to assess a society's willingness to pay for health. The WHO at one point recommended that the threshold be 1 to 3 times the gross domestic product per capita. But more recently, we've been trying to estimate the opportunity cost of new technologies or interventions. So a couple of years ago, as part of the project with Carl Claxton at the University of York, when they estimated a UK threshold, Nancy Devlin, who is part of that team, tried to figure out what services or interventions were being displaced by looking at what decision makers stopped doing. And the idea was that if we know what has been stopped, then the health lost from having stopped that activity would be the opportunity cost of new treatments. But she found that decision makers don't really make very clear decisions about stopping things. Mm-hmm. And I think things get pushed out slowly and quietly as doctors just can't do everything they did before. So that has encouraged a number of people to try to assess health systems data using data about changes in costs and effects. And the idea is that the marginal productivity of the healthcare system, or the relationship between changes in healthcare expenditures and health outcomes, is a direct measure of the health consequences of changes in available resources. So if we spent one more dollar on a new technology, the marginal productivity would tell us the effect of spending one less dollar in the current system. So that gives us kind of an estimate of our threshold. So with the project that you mentioned, currently we've been trying to estimate a cost-effectiveness threshold for cancer care in Alberta. And so we have like 3 million data points, observations on 280,000 individuals who've been diagnosed with cancer in Alberta. And we have data on them over 12 years. And so from that data, we're trying to estimate the life expectancy of patients with cancer in Alberta and their costs. We're still trying to work on estimating their health-related quality of life. We've had some difficulty getting that data. But once we get these results, we'll combine the health-related quality of life and the life expectancy to estimate a quality-adjusted life year. And then with the costs, we'll estimate the marginal productivity. So we'll regress costs on qualies and look at what that marginal effect of costs on qualies is. Of course, it's not quite that simple. Costs and qualities are endogenous, so we have to think about different types of models to control for endogeneity. And so we've started to look at appropriate instrumental variables so that we can do an IV model.
Wow, that's very interesting. My next question would be, we have been talking about a single cost effectiveness threshold. However, in reality, a healthcare system might have more than one threshold or even a threshold range. For example, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, or NICE agents in the UK, they use a higher threshold for end-of-life treatments. So what are the implications of using different thresholds for different treatments?
You're right. So NICE, who actually changed their name to National Institute of Care and Health Excellence,
okay.
they use different thresholds for end-of-life care. And then they also have a range of thresholds that they use from 20 to 30,000 pounds for other treatments. So let's think about the effect of the range first. So the incentive for the manufacturer, who knows what NICE is willing to pay for a threshold, which is their 20 to 30,000 pounds, has an incentive to price their product right up to the threshold. So using their modeling, they're going to try to find that price that maximizes their profit. So other than the end-of-life treatments, the upper range is only supposed to be available for treatments with a high degree of certainty around the ICER, or if there's other benefits that are not captured, or if the technology is what they consider innovative.
Mm-hmm.
However, these are really difficult criteria to define, and during my experience sitting on a NICE Health Technology Appraisal Committee, effectively you have just a single threshold of 30,000 pounds per quality. The manufacturer is not aiming for the 20,000 pounds per quality threshold, and it's really hard to judge if the ICER has a high degree of certainty and et cetera. So most decisions are made right around the 30,000 pounds per quality. So having a range between 20 and 30 just means that you have an actual threshold of 30.
Mm-hmm.
So then the other piece is that they have different thresholds for different types of treatments or different populations, really. So for treatments that are for patients at the end of their life, and they have kind of a weird definition of that. They define this as patients with 2 years left to live. And the treatment has to be an improvement of at least 3 months of life expectancy. And it has to be a small population.
Mm-hmm.
So treatments that fit that criteria are assessed at a different threshold. And the threshold is 50,000 pounds per quality. So what this does is it suggests that there's a different societal value to treat patients at the end of life over patients at other points in their lives. So it suggests we prefer cancer treatments and end-of-life treatments, but lots of cancer treatments fall into this, over things like preventative care, screening, things that happened earlier on in our lives. And we can actually measure the value of a person's life at the end of life compared to others because if we spend 50,000 pounds on a quali for a patient at the end of life, that costs two qualies of someone else's health. That's the opportunity cost of a 50,000 pound per quali threshold. So this shifts resources to people at the end of life, and it incentivizes manufacturers to invest in treatments that will keep patients alive for at least 3 months. And I think there are some interesting implications that come out of this for a person who has 2 years to live. NICE is indifferent from adding 3 months to their life or 6 months to someone's life who has 3 years to live, even though the additional years both happen at the end of the person's life. So you don't want to treat someone 3 years earlier, even if it gives them more end-of-life benefit, right? So it you have to think through kind of the implications. But if this is really a value that's held by the UK, and I think there are people trying to collect data on this to make sure that this aligns with UK values, then maybe this additional threshold makes sense. But we just have to consider the important trade-offs that are being made when we implement different thresholds for different populations and what that says about our societal values and our preferences.
And there are also cases where new technologies would not be cost-effective, even at a zero cost. So can you explain further how this situation arises and how to deal with it?
Yeah, so this occurs usually when there's a follow-up treatment after the new treatment, and that follow-up treatment is not cost-effective. So if a new patient is kept alive by this new treatment and they live longer, but the subsequent treatment they receive is really expensive and not very beneficial for them, then when we model out that the costs and benefits of that new treatment, we have all these additional follow-up costs that are huge, and sometimes they overcome all the cost benefits of the initial or new treatment that the patient received. This has been a complaint of a number of manufacturers, and we've had to deal with this with NICE as well, because it doesn't seem fair to manufacturers that their new treatment isn't cost effective, not because of the cost of their treatment, but of the subsequent treatment afterwards. The thing is it's a real opportunity cost of that new treatment. That is really what's going to happen, and that really affects the health of the other population if you believe in opportunity cost and fixed budgets and so on. So there are some arguments against adding the cost of the poor follow-up treatments, and you might think about the fact that we already don't add costs of non-disease-specific treatment. So when we model, when we do our assessments, we don't add the costs of a potential heart attack of a patient who's having a cancer treatment, unless we think the cancer treatment leads to that heart attack. So we don't model normally the other health costs of a patient. We focus on the disease-specific ones. And so we might think that these follow-up costs, even though they're disease-specific, you might justify excluding them in the same way that you exclude other diseases. But I don't think the first thing that we do is very justified if we're really looking at opportunity costs. I think we should be including all costs, whether they're related to the disease or not related to the disease. So I don't think that's a good justification for leaving out those subsequent costs.
Wow, perfect. There are very good insights there. But now let's switch gears to a country that does not have a clear threshold to define which technologies will be incorporated in the healthcare system, such as Canada. So in this case, what are the challenges in estimating and implementing a cost-effectiveness threshold?
The advantage that Canada has is that we have some very good data. Some of the provinces collect costs and outcomes, at least life expectancy, on all of their patients, everyone who is in the system. And we're getting better at collecting some of the other outcomes as well. So the Canadian Community Health Survey started collecting quality of life measures. And within Alberta, we've also started trying to collect health-related quality of life measures. So with the really good data that we have, I think that it is possible to estimate a cost-effectiveness threshold for Canada. It's difficult to say for Canada because there's such a variety in the provinces that there's variety in practice patterns and what the physicians are doing and even the cost of the things that they're using. So having one single threshold for Canada might be a little bit debatable given this variation. But I think we could get good estimates for some provinces. We could do it individually for every province. And some provinces have really good data. But for those provinces who don't, the best evidence probably comes from neighboring provinces anyway. So in that way, we can kind of estimate a threshold for all of Canada. I think one of the big difficulties is in implementing a threshold is that it's difficult to explicitly use costs in decision making. I've had experiences sitting across from a patient group representative and we're saying, you know, this new treatment isn't cost effective according to our models. And they're saying, you know, I just want to live for 3 more months. I want to be able to watch my child play baseball this summer. And I think this treatment is going to give me that opportunity. And you're saying that we can't afford to let me live these 3 months. You know, you're not going to give me that chance. So there's really difficult decisions to be made. And using costs as part of that is not popular. And people think that economists are technocrats focused on dollars and that all we care about is cost saving. But I hope kind of over our discussion that you can see that opportunity costs, although we measure them in dollars often, they represent somebody else's health. And when we say we can't afford to spend money, it's not that we don't have the money, but there's a better use of that money. And there's a better opportunity cost. And so I think it's our responsibility to explain opportunity costs. That's what our job as health economists is. And not in terms of dollars, but in terms of health loss to society. And we need to have a best estimate of the cost effectiveness threshold to do that, to really use that threshold to show people what the opportunity costs are and to say, this is affecting society, this is affecting other people's health when we use treatments to help people.
Wow, that is a great point to finish our discussion. Thank you so much, Eldon, for your time and insights. I hope you liked the episode and stay tuned in the Health Economics and Policy Podcast for more interesting interviews.
Thank you.